to an army hospital outside Vienna. Given his expertise in tailoring, he was given a job that at least resembled his profession. Cartloads of uniforms and socks and shirts would come in every week, and he would mend what needed mending, even if they could only be used as underclothes for the suffering soldiers in Russia. Hans was sent first, quite ironically, to Stuttgart, and later to Essen. He was given one of the most undesirable positions on the home front, the LSE. A necessary explanation. LSE. Luftwaffe Sondereinheit. Air Raid Special Unit. The job of the LSE was to remain above ground during air raids and put out fires, prop up the walls of buildings, and rescue anyone who'd been trapped during the raid. As Hans soon discovered, there was also an alternative definition for the acronym. The men in the unit would explain to him on his first day that it really stood for Leichensammler-Einheit, dead body collectors. When he arrived, Hans could only guess what those men had done to deserve such a task, and in turn they wanted the same of him. Their leader, Sergeant Boris Schipper, asked him straight out. When Hans explained the bread, the Jews, and the whip, the round-faced sergeant gave out a short spurt of laughter. "You're lucky to be alive!" His eyes were also round, and he was constantly wiping them. They were either tired or itchy, or full of smoke and dust. "Just remember that the enemy here is not in front of you." Hans was about to ask the obvious question, when a voice arrived from behind. Attached to it was the slender face of a young man with a smile like a sneer. Reinhold Zucker. "With us," he said, "the enemy isn't over the hill, or in any specific direction. It's all around." He returned his focus to the letter he was writing. "You'll see." In the messy space of a few months, Reinhold Zucker would be dead. He would be killed by Hans Hubermann's seat. As the war flew into Germany with more intensity, Hans would learn that every one of his shifts started in the same fashion. The men would gather at the truck to be briefed on what had been hit during their break, what was most likely to be hit next, and who was working with whom. Even when no raids were in operation, there would still be a great deal of work to be done. They would drive through broken towns, cleaning up. In the truck, there were 12 slouched men, all rising and falling with the various inconsistencies in the road. From the beginning, it was clear that they all owned a seat. Reinhold Zucker's was in the middle of the left row. Hans Hubermann's was at the very back, where the daylight stretched itself out. He learned quickly to be on the lookout for any rubbish that might be thrown from anywhere in the truck's interior. Hans reserved a special respect for cigarette butts, still burning as they whistled by. A complete letter home. "To my dear Rosa and Liesel, everything is fine here. I hope you are both well. With love, Papa." In late November, he had his first smoky taste of an actual raid. The truck was mobbed by rubble, and there was much running and shouting. Fires were burning, and the ruined cases of buildings were piled up in mounds. Framework leaned. The smoke bombs stood like matchsticks in the ground, filling the city's lungs. Hans Hubermann was in a group of four. They formed a line. Sergeant Boris Schipper was at the front, his arms disappearing into the smoke. Behind him was Kessler, then Brunnenweg, then Hubermann. As the sergeant hosed the fire, the other two men hosed the sergeant, and just to make sure, Hubermann hosed all three of them. Behind him, a building groaned and tripped. It fell face first, stopping a few meters from his heels. The concrete smelled brand new, and the wall of powder rushed at them. "Gott verdammt, Hubermann!" The voice struggled out of the flames. It was followed immediately by three men. Their throats were filled with particles of ash. Even when they made it around the corner, away from the center of the wreckage, the haze of the collapsed building attempted to follow. It was white and warm, and it crept behind them. Slumped in temporary safety, there was much coughing and swearing. The sergeant repeated his earlier sentiments. "God damn it, Huberman!" He scraped at his lips to loosen them. "What the hell was that?"
"It just collapsed, right behind us."
"That much I know already. The question is, how big was it? It must have been 10 stories high."
"No, sir. Just 2, I think."
"Jesus!" A coughing fit. "Mary and Joseph!"
Now he yanked at the paste of sweat and powder in his eye sockets. "Not much you could do about that."
One of the other men wiped his face and said, "Just once. I want to be there when they hit a pub, for Christ's sake. I'm dying for a beer."
Each man leaned back. They could all taste it, putting out the fires in their throats and softening the smoke. It was a nice dream, and an impossible one. They were all aware that any beer that flowed in these streets would not be beer at all, but a kind of milkshake or porridge. All 4 men were plastered with a grey and white conglomeration of dust. When they stood up fully to resume work, only small cracks of their uniform could be seen. The sergeant walked to Brunnenweg. He brushed heavily at his chest, several smacks.
"That's better. You had some dust on there, my friend."
As Brunnenweg laughed, the sergeant turned to his newest recruit.
"You first this time, Huberman."
They put the fires out for several hours, and they found anything they could to convince a building to remain standing. In some cases, where the sides were damaged, the remaining edges poked out like elbows. This was Hans Huberman's strong point. He almost came to enjoy finding a smouldering rafter or disheveled slab of concrete to prop those elbows up, to give them something to rest on. His hands were packed tightly with splinters, and his teeth were caked with residue from the fallout. Both lips were set with moist dust that had hardened, and there wasn't a pocket, a thread, or a hidden crease in his uniform that wasn't covered in a film left by the loaded air. The worst part of the job was the people. Once in a while, there was a person roaming doggedly through the fog, mostly single-worded. They always shouted a name. Sometimes it was Wolfgang.
"Have you seen my Wolfgang?"
Their handprints would remain on his jacket.
"Stefanie."
"Hansi."
"Gustl. Gustl Stoboy."
As the density subsided, the roll call of names limped through the ruptured streets, sometimes ending with an ash-filled embrace or a knelt-down howl of grief. They accumulated hour by hour, like sweet and sour dreams, waiting to happen. The dangers merged into one. Powder and smoke and the gusty flames. The damaged people. Like the rest of the men in the unit, Hans would need to perfect the art of forgetting.
"How are you, Huberman?"
the sergeant asked at one point. Fire was at his shoulder. Hans nodded uneasily at the pair of them. Midway through the shift, there was an old man who staggered defensively through the streets. As Hans finished stabilizing a building, he turned to find him at his back, waiting calmly for his turn. A bloodstain was signed across his face. It trailed off down his throat and neck. He was wearing a white shirt with a dark red collar, and he held his leg as if it was next to him.
"Could you prop me up now, young man?"
Hans picked him up and carried him out of the haze. A small, sad note. I visited that small city street with the man still in Hans Huberman's arms. The sky was white horse grey. It wasn't until he placed him down on a patch of concrete-coated grass that Hans noticed.
"What is it?"
one of the other men asked. Hans could only point.
"Oh,"
a hand pulled him away.
"Get used to it, Huberman."
For the rest of the shift, he threw himself into duty. He tried to ignore the distant echoes of calling people. After perhaps 2 hours, he rushed from a building with the sergeant and 2 other men. He didn't watch the ground and tripped. Only when he returned to his haunches and saw the others looking in distress at the obstacle did he realize. The corpse was face down. It lay in a blanket of powder and dust, and it was holding its ears. It was a boy, perhaps 11 or 12 years old. Not far away, as they progressed along the street, they found a woman calling the name Rudolph. She was drawn to the four men and met them in the mist. Her body was frail and bent with worry.
"Have you seen my boy?"
"How old is he?" the sergeant asked.
12.
"Oh, Christ. Oh, crucified Christ." They all thought it, but the sergeant could not bring himself to tell her or point the way. As the woman tried to push past, Boris Schipper held her back.
"We've just come from that street," he assured her. "You won't find him down there."
The bent woman still clung to hope. She called over her shoulder as she half walked, half ran.
"Rudy!"
Hans Hubermann thought of another Rudy then, the Himmel Street variety. "Please," he asked into a sky he couldn't see, "let Rudy be safe." His thoughts naturally progressed to Liesel and Rosa, and the Steiners, and Max. When they made it to the rest of the men, he dropped down and lay on his back.
"How was it down there?" someone asked.
Papa's lungs were full of sky. A few hours later, when he'd washed and eaten and thrown up, he attempted to write a detailed letter home. His hands were uncontrollable, forcing him to make it short. If he could bring himself, the remainder would be told verbally, when and if he made it home. "To my dear Rosa and Liesel," he began. It took many minutes to write those 6 words down. The Bread Eaters. It had been a long and eventful year in Malking, and it was finally drawing to a close. Liesel spent the last few months of 1942 consumed by thoughts of what she called 3 desperate men. She wondered where they were and what they were doing. One afternoon, she lifted the accordion from its case and polished it with a rag. Only once, just before she put it away, did she take the step that Mama could not. She placed her finger on one of the keys and softly pumped the bellows. Rosa had been right. It only made the room feel emptier. Whenever she met Rudy, she asked if there had been any word from his father. Sometimes he described to her in detail one of Alex Steiner's letters. By comparison, the one letter her own papa had sent was somewhat of a disappointment. Max, of course, was entirely up to her imagination. It was with great optimism that she envisioned him walking alone on a deserted road. Once in a while, she imagined him falling into a doorway of safety somewhere, his identity card enough to fool the right person. The 3 men would turn up everywhere. She saw her papa in the window at school. Max often sat with her by the fire. Alex Steiner arrived when she was with Rudy, staring back at them after they'd slammed the bikes down on Munich Street and looked into the shop. "Look at those suits," Rudy would say to her, his head and hands against the glass. "All going to waste." Strangely, one of Liesel's favorite distractions was Frau Holzapfel. The reading sessions included Wednesday now as well, and they'd finished the water-abridged version of the Whistler and were on to the Dream Carrier. The old woman sometimes made tea, or gave Liesel some soup that was infinitely better than Mama's. Less watery. Between October and December, there had been one more parade of Jews, with one to follow. As on the previous occasion, Liesel had rushed to Munich Street, this time to see if Max Vandenberg was among them. She was torn between the obvious urge to see him, to know that he was still alive, and an absence that could mean any number of things, one of which being freedom. In mid-December, a small collection of Jews and other miscreants was brought down Munich Street again, to Dachau. Parade number 3. Rudy walked purposefully down Himmel Street and returned from number 35 with a small bag and two bikes.
You game, Saumensch?
The contents of Rudy's bag. 6 stale pieces of bread, broken into quarters. They pedaled ahead of the parade toward Dachau and stopped at an empty piece of road. Rudy passed Liesel the bag.
Take a handful. I'm not sure this is a good idea.
He slapped some bread onto her palm.
Your papa did.
How could she argue? It was worth a whipping. If we're fast, we won't get caught. He started distributing the bread.
So move it, Saumensch.
Liesel couldn't help herself. There was the trace of a grin on her face as she and Rudi Steiner, her best friend, handed out the pieces of bread on the road. When they were finished, they took their bikes and hid among the Christmas trees. The road was cold and straight. It wasn't long till the soldiers came with the Jews. In the tree shadows, Liesel watched the boy. How things had changed, from fruit stealer to bread giver. His blonde hair, although darkening, was like a candle. She heard his stomach growl, and he was giving people bread. Was this Germany? Was this Nazi Germany? The first soldier did not see the bread. He was not hungry. But the first Jew saw it. His ragged hand reached down and picked a piece up and shoved it deliriously to his mouth.
Is that Max? Liesel thought.
She could not see properly and moved to get a better view.
Hey! Rudy was livid. Don't move! If they find us here and match us to the bread, we're history!
Liesel continued. More Jews were bending down and taking bread from the road, and from the edge of the trees, the book thief examined each and every one of them. Max Vandenberg was not there. Relief was short-lived. It stirred itself around her, just as one of the soldiers noticed a prisoner drop a hand to the ground. Everyone was ordered to stop. The road was closely examined. The prisoners chewed as fast and silently as they could. Collectively, they gulped. The soldier picked up a few pieces and studied each side of the road. The prisoners also looked.
In there!
One of the soldiers was striding over to the girl by the closest trees. Next, he saw the boy. Both began to run. They chose different directions, under the rafters of branches and the tall ceiling of the trees.
Don't stop running, Liesel! What about the bikes? Scheiß drauf! Shit on them! Who cares?
They ran, and after 100 meters, the hunched breath of the soldier drew closer. It sidled up next to her, and she waited for the accompanying hand. She was lucky. All she received was a boot up the arse and a fistful of words.
Keep running, little girl. You don't belong here.
She ran, and she did not stop for at least another mile. Branches sliced her arms, pine cones rolled at her feet, and the taste of Christmas needles chimed inside her lungs. A good 45 minutes had passed by the time she made it back, and Rudy was sitting by the rusty bikes. He'd collected what was left of the bread and was chewing on a stale, stiff portion.
I told you not to get too close, he said.
She showed him her backside.
Have I got a footprint?
The Hidden Sketchbook. A few days before Christmas, there was another raid, although nothing dropped on the town of Malking. According to the radio news, most of the bombs fell in open country. What was most important was the reaction in the Fiedler's shelter. Once the last few patrons had arrived, everyone settled down solemnly and waited. They looked at her, expectantly. Papa's voice arrived, loud in her ears.
And if there are more raids, keep reading in the shelter.
Liesel waited. She needed to be sure that they wanted it. Rudy spoke for everyone.
Read, Saumensch.
She opened the book, and again the words found their way upon all those present in the shelter. At home, Once the sirens had given permission for everyone to return above ground, Liesel sat in the kitchen with her mama. A preoccupation was at the forefront of Rosa Huberman's expression, and it was not long until she picked up a knife and left the room.
"Come with me."
She walked to the living room and took the sheet from the edge of her mattress. In the side, there was a sewn-up slit. If you didn't know beforehand that it was there, there was almost no chance of finding it. Rosa cut it carefully open and inserted her hand, reaching in the length of her entire arm. When it came back out, she was holding Max Vandenberg's sketchbook.
"He said to give this to you when you were ready," she said. "I was thinking your birthday. Then I brought it back to Christmas."
Rosa Huberman stood, and there was a strange look on her face. It was not made up of pride. Perhaps it was the thickness, the heaviness of recollection. She said,
"I think you've always been ready, Liesel. From the moment you arrived here, clinging to that gate, you were meant to have this."
Rosa gave her the book. The cover looked like this. "The Word Shaker, a small collection of thoughts for Liesel Memminger." Liesel held it with soft hands. She stared.
"Thanks, Mama."
She embraced her.
There was also a great longing to tell Rosa Huberman that she loved her.
It's a shame she didn't say it. She wanted to read the book in the basement for old time's sake, but Mama convinced her otherwise.
"There's a reason Max got sick down there," she said, "and I can tell you one thing, girl, I'm not letting you get sick."
She read in the kitchen, red and yellow gaps in the stove. "The Word Shaker." She made her way through the countless sketches and stories and the pictures with captions. Things like Rudy on a dais with three gold medals slung around his neck. "Hair the color of lemons" was written beneath it. The snowman made an appearance, as did a list of the 13 presents, not to mention the records of countless nights in the basement or by the fire. Of course, there were many thoughts, sketches, and dreams relating to Stuttgart and Germany and the Führer. Recollections of Max's family were also there. In the end, he could not resist including them. He had to. Then came page 117. That was where the Word Shaker itself made its appearance. It was a fable or a fairy tale. Liesel was not sure which. Even days later, when she looked up both terms in the Duden Dictionary, she couldn't distinguish between the two. On the previous page, there was a small note. Page 116. "Liesel, I almost scribbled this story out. I thought you might be too old for such a tale, but maybe no one is. I thought of you and your books and words, and this strange story came into my head. I hope you can find some good in it." She turned the page. There was once a strange small man. He decided three important details about his life. One, he would part his hair from the opposite side to everyone else. Two, he would make himself a small, strange mustache. Three, he would one day rule the world. The young man wandered around for quite some time, thinking, planning, and figuring out exactly how to make the world his. Then one day, out of nowhere, it struck him. The perfect plan. He'd seen a mother walking with her child. At one point, she admonished the small boy until finally he began to cry. Within a few minutes, she spoke very softly to him, after which she was soothed and even smiled. The young man rushed to the woman and embraced her. "Words," he grinned. "What?" But there was no reply. He was already gone. Yes, the Führer decided that he would rule the world with words. "I will never fire a gun," he devised. "I will not have to." Still, he was not rash. Let's allow him at least that much. He was not a stupid man at all. His first plan of attack was to plant the words in as many areas of his homeland as possible. He planted them day and night and cultivated them. He watched them grow until eventually great forests of words had risen throughout Germany. It was a nation of farmed thoughts. While the words were growing, our young Führer also planted seeds to create symbols, and these too were well on their way to full bloom. Now the time had come. The Führer was ready. He invited his people toward his own glorious heart, beckoning them with his finest, ugliest words, hand-picked from his forests, and the people came. They were all placed on a conveyor belt and run through a rampant machine that gave them a lifetime in 10 minutes. Words were fed into them. Time disappeared, and they now knew everything they needed to know. They were hypnotized. Next, they were fitted with their symbols, and everyone was happy. Soon the demand for the lovely, ugly words and symbols increased to such a point that as the forests grew, many people were needed to maintain them. Some were employed to climb the trees and throw the words down to those below. They were then fed directly into the remainder of the Führer's people, not to mention those who came back for more. The people who climbed the trees were called word shakers. The best word shakers were the ones who understood the true power of words. They were the ones who could climb the highest. One such word shaker was a small, skinny girl. She was renowned as the best word shaker of her region because she knew how powerless a person could be without words. That's why she could climb higher than anyone else. She had desire. She was hungry for them. One day, however, she met a man who was despised by her homeland, even though he was born in it. They became good friends, and when the man was sick, the word shaker allowed a single teardrop to fall on his face. The tear was made of friendship, a single word, and it dried and became a seed, and when next the girl was in the forest, she planted that seed among the other trees. She watered it every day. At first, there was nothing. But one afternoon, when she checked it after a day of word shaking, a small sprout had shot up. She stared at it for a long time. The tree grew every day, faster than everything else, till it was the tallest tree in the forest. Everyone came to look at it. They all whispered about it, and they waited for the Führer. Incensed, he immediately ordered the tree to be cut down. That was when the word shaker made her way through the crowd. She fell to her hands and knees. "Please," she cried, "you can't cut it down." The Führer, however, was unmoved. He could not afford to make exceptions. As the word shaker was dragged away, he turned to his right-hand man and made a request. "Axe, please." At that moment, the word shaker twisted free. She ran. She boarded the tree. And even as the Führer hammered at the trunk with his axe, she climbed until she reached the highest of the branches. The voices and axe beats continued faintly on. Clouds walked by, like white monsters with gray hearts. Afraid but stubborn, the word shaker remained. She waited for the tree to fall. But the tree would not move. Many hours passed, and still the Führer's axe could not take a single bite out of the trunk. In a state nearing collapse, he ordered another man to continue. Days passed. Weeks took over. 196 soldiers could not make any impact on the word shaker's tree. "But how does she eat?" the people asked. "How does she sleep?" What they didn't know was that other word shakers threw supplies across, and the girl climbed down to the lower branches to collect them. It snowed. It rained. Seasons came and went. The word shaker remained. When the last X-Man gave up, he called up to her, "Word shaker, you can come down now. There is no one who can defeat this tree." The word shaker, who could only just make out the man's sentences, replied with a whisper. She handed it down through the branches. "No, thank you," she said, for she knew that it was only herself who was holding the tree upright. No one knew how long it had taken, but one afternoon, a new X-Man walked into town. His bag looked too heavy for him. His eyes dragged. His feet drooped with exhaustion. "The tree," he asked the people. "Where is the tree?" An audience followed him, and when he arrived, clouds had covered the highest regions of the branches. The word shaker could hear the people calling out that a new X-Man had come to put an end to her vigil. "She will not come down," the people said, "for anyone." They did not know who the X-Man was, and they did not know that he was undeterred. He opened his bag and pulled out something much smaller than an axe. The people laughed. They said, "You can't chop a tree down with an old hammer." The young man did not listen to them. He only looked through his bag for some nails. He placed three of them in his mouth and attempted to hammer a fourth one into the tree. The first branches were now extremely high, and he estimated that he needed four nails to use as footholds to reach them. "Look at this idiot," roared one of the watching men. "No one else could chop it down with an axe, and this fool thinks he can do it with..." The man fell silent. The first nail entered the tree and was held steady after five blows. Then the second went in, and the young man started to climb. By the fourth nail, he was up in the arms and continued on his way. He was tempted to call out as he did so, but he decided against it. The climb seemed to last for miles. It took many hours for him to reach the final branches, and when he did, he found the word shaker asleep in her blankets and the clouds. He watched her for many minutes. The warmth of the sun heated the cloudy rooftop. He reached down, touching her arm, and the word shaker woke up. She rubbed her eyes, and after a long study of his face, she spoke. "Is it really you? Is it from your cheek," she thought, "that I took the seed?" The man nodded. His heart wobbled, and he held tighter to the branches. "It is." Together, they stayed in the summit of the tree. They waited for the clouds to disappear, and when they did, they could see the rest of the forest. "It wouldn't stop growing," she explained. "But neither would this." The young man looked at the branch that held his hand. He had a point. When they had looked and talked enough, they made their way back down. They left the blankets and remaining food behind. The people could not believe what they were seeing, and the moment the word shaker and the young man set foot in the world, the tree finally began to show the axe marks. Bruises appeared, slits were made in the trunk, and the earth began to shiver. "It's going to fall," a young woman screamed. "The tree is going to fall." She was right. The word shaker's tree, in all its miles and miles of height, slowly began to tip. It moaned as it was sucked to the ground. The world shook, and when everything finally settled, the tree was laid out among the rest of the forest. It could never destroy all of it, but if nothing else, a different colored path was carved through it. The word shaker and the young man climbed up to the horizontal trunk. They navigated the branches and began to walk. When they looked back, they noticed that the majority of onlookers had started to return to their own places. In there, out there, in the forest. But as they walked on, They stopped several times to listen. They thought they could hear voices and words behind them, on the Word Shaker's tree. For a long time, Liesel sat at the kitchen table and wondered where Max Vandenberg was in all that forest out there. The light lay down around her. She fell asleep. Mama made her go to bed, and she did so, with Max's sketchbook against her chest. It was hours later, when she woke up, that the answer to her question came.
"Of course," she whispered. "Of course I know where he is."
And she went back to sleep. She dreamed of the tree. The Anarchist's Suit Collection. 35 Himmel Street, December the 24th. With the absence of two fathers, the Steiners have invited Rosa and Trudy Huberman and Liesel. When they arrive, Rudy is still in the process of explaining his clothes. He looks at Liesel and his mouth widens, but only slightly. The days leading up to Christmas 1942 fell thick and heavy with snow. Liesel went through the Word Shaker many times, from the story itself to the many sketches and commentaries on either side of it. On Christmas Eve, she made a decision about Rudy. To hell with being out too late. She walked next door just before dark and told him she had a present for him for Christmas. Rudy looked at her hands and either side of her feet.
"Well, where the hell is it?"
"Forget it, then."
But Rudy knew. He'd seen her like this before. Risky eyes and sticky fingers. The breath of stealing was all around her, and he could smell it.
"This gift," he estimated. "You haven't got it yet, have you?"
"No."
"And you're not buying it either."
"Of course not. Do you think I have any money?"
Snow was still falling. At the edge of the grass, there was ice like broken glass.
"Do you have the key?"
she asked.
"The key to what?"
But it didn't take Rudy long to understand. He made his way inside and returned not long after. In the words of Victor Chemmel, he said,
"It's time to go shopping."
The light was disappearing fast, and except for the church, all of Munich Street had closed up for Christmas. Liesel walked hurriedly to remain in step with the lankier stride of her neighbor. They arrived at the designated shop window. Steiner, Schneidermeister. The glass wore a thin sheet of mud and grime that had blown onto it in the passing weeks. On the opposite side, the mannequins stood like witnesses. They were serious and ludicrously stylish. It was hard to shake the feeling that they were watching everything. Rudy reached into his pocket. It was Christmas Eve. His father was near Vienna. He didn't think he'd mind if they trespassed in his beloved shop. The circumstances demanded it. The door opened fluently, and they made their way inside. Rudy's first instinct was to hit the light switch, but the electricity had already been cut off.
"Any candles?"
Rudy was dismayed.
"I brought the key. And besides, this was your idea."
In the middle of the exchange, Liesel tripped on a bump in the floor. A mannequin followed her down. It groped her arm and dismantled in its clothes on top of her.
"Get this thing off me!"
It was in four pieces, the torso and head, the legs, and two separate arms. When she was rid of it, Liesel stood and wheezed.
"Jesus Mary!"
Rudy found one of the arms and tapped her on the shoulder with its hand. When she turned in fright, he extended it in friendship.
"Nice to meet you."
For a few minutes, they moved slowly through the tight pathways of the shop. Rudy started toward the counter. When he fell over an empty box, he yelped and swore, then found his way back to the entrance.
"This is ridiculous," he said. "Wait here a minute."
Liesel sat, mannequin arm in hand, till he returned with a lit lantern from the church. A ring of light circled his face.
"So where's this present you've been bragging about? It better not be one of these weird mannequins. Bring the light over."
When he made it to the far left section of the shop, Liesel took the lantern with one hand and swept through the hanging suits with the other. She pulled one out, but quickly replaced it with another.
Nope, still too big.
After two more attempts, she held a navy blue suit in front of Rudi Steiner.
Does this look about your size?
While Liesl sat in the dark, Rudi tried on the suit behind one of the curtains. There was a small circle of light and the shadow dressing itself. When he returned, he held out the lantern for Liesl to see. Free of the curtain, the light was like a pillar shining onto the refined suit. It also lit up the dirty shirt beneath and Rudy's battered shoes.
Well?
He asked. Liesl continued the examination. She moved around him and shrugged.
Not bad. Not bad? I look better than just not bad. The shoes let you down. And your face.
Rudi placed the lantern on the counter and came toward her in mock anger, and Liesl had to admit that a nervousness started gripping her. It was with both relief and disappointment that she watched him trip and fall on the disgraced mannequin. On the floor, Rudi laughed. Then he closed his eyes, clenching them hard. Liesl rushed over. She crouched above him.
Kiss him, Liesl, kiss him.
Are you all right, Rudi? Rudi?
I miss him,
said the boy, sideways, across the floor.
Frohe Weihnachten,
Liesl replied. She helped him up, straightening the suit.
Merry Christmas.
Part 9. The Last Human Stranger. Featuring The Next Temptation, A Card Player, The Snows of Stalingrad, An Ageless Brother, An Accident, The Bitter Taste of Questions, A Toolbox, A Bleeder, A Bear, A Broken Plane, and A Homecoming. The Next Temptation.
This time, there were cookies, but they were stale. There were kipfel, left over from Christmas, and they'd been sitting on the desk for at least 2 weeks. Like miniature horseshoes with a layer of icing sugar, the ones on the bottom were bolted to the plate. The rest were piled on top, forming a chewy mound. She could already smell them when her fingers tightened on the window ledge. The room tasted like sugar and dough, and thousands of pages. There was no note, but it didn't take Liesl long to realize that Ilse Hermann had been at it again, and she certainly wasn't taking the chance that the cookies might not be for her. She made her way back to the window and passed a whisper through the gap. The whisper's name was Rudi. They'd gone on foot that day because the road was too slippery for bikes. The boy was beneath the window standing watch. When she called out, his face appeared, and she presented him with the plate. He didn't need much convincing to take it. His eyes feasted on the cookies, and he asked a few questions.
Anything else? Any milk? What? Milk,
he repeated, a little louder this time. If he'd recognized the offended tone in Liesl's voice, he certainly wasn't showing it. The book thief's face appeared above him again.
Are you stupid? Can I just steal the book? Of course. All I'm saying is...
Liesl moved toward the far shelf behind the desk. She found some paper and a pen in the top drawer and wrote, "Thank you," leaving the note on top. To her right, a book protruded like a bone. Its paleness was almost scarred by the dark lettering of the title. Die letzte menschliche Fremde, The Last Human Stranger. It whispered softly as she removed it from the shelf. Some dust showered down. At the window, just as she was about to make her way out, the library door creaked apart. Her knee was up, and her book-stealing hand was poised against the window frame. When she faced the noise, she found the mayor's wife in a brand-new bathrobe and slippers. On the breast pocket of the robe sat an embroidered swastika. Propaganda even reached the bathroom. They watched each other. Liesl looked at Ilse Hermann's breast and raised her arm.
Heil Hitler!
She was just about to leave when a realization struck her. The cookies. They'd been there for weeks. That meant that if the mayor himself used the library, he must have seen them. He must have asked why they were there, or... And as soon as Liesel felt this thought, it filled her with a strange optimism. Perhaps it wasn't the mayor's library at all. It was hers. Ilse Hermann's. She didn't know why it was so important, but she enjoyed the fact that the roomful of books belonged to the woman. It was she who introduced her to the library in the first place, and gave her the initial, even literal, window of opportunity. This way was better. It all seemed to fit. Just as she began to move again, she propped everything and asked, "This is your room, isn't it?" The mayor's wife tightened. "I used to read in here with my son, but then..." Liesel's hand touched the air behind her. She saw a mother reading on the floor with a young boy pointing at the pictures and the words. Then she saw a war at the window.
"I know."
An exclamation entered from outside.
"What did you say?"
Liesel spoke in a harsh whisper behind her.
"Keep quiet, Saukerl, and watch the street."
To Ilse Hermann, she handed the words slowly across.
"So all these books?"
"They're mostly mine. Some are my husband's, some were my son's, as you know."
There was embarrassment now on Liesel's behalf. Her cheeks were set alight.
"I always thought this was the mayor's room."
"Why?"
The woman seemed amused. Liesel noticed that there were also swastikas on the toes of her slippers.
"He's the mayor. I thought he'd read a lot."
The mayor's wife placed her hands in her side pockets.
"Lately, it's you who gets the most use out of this room."
"Have you read this one?"
Liesel held up The Last Human Stranger. Ilse looked more closely at the title.
"I have, yes."
"Any good?" "Not bad."
There was an itch to leave then, but also a peculiar obligation to stay. She moved to speak, but the available words were too many and too fast. There were several attempts to snatch at them, but it was the mayor's wife who took the initiative. She saw Rudy's face in the window, or more to the point, his candle-lit hair.
"I think you'd better go," she said. "He's waiting for you."
On the way home, they ate.
"Are you sure there wasn't anything else?" Rudy asked. "There must have been. We were lucky to get the cookies."
Liesel examined the gift in Rudy's arms.
"Now tell the truth. Did you eat any before I came back out?"
Rudy was indignant.
"Hey, you're the thief here, not me. Don't kid me, Saukerl. I could see some sugar at the side of your mouth."
Paranoid, Rudy took the plate in just the one hand and wiped with the other.
"I didn't eat any, I promise."
Half the cookies were gone before they hit the bridge, and they shared the rest with Tommy Müller on Himmel Street. When they'd finished eating, there was only one afterthought, and Rudy spoke it.
"What the hell do we do with the plate?"
The card player. Around the time Liesel and Rudy were eating the cookies, the resting men of the LSE were playing cards in a town not far from Essen. They'd just completed the long trip from Stuttgart and were gambling for cigarettes. Reinhold Zucker was not a happy man.
"He's cheating, I swear it," he muttered.
They were in a shed that served as their barracks, and Hans Hubermann had just won his third consecutive hand. Zucker threw his cards down in disgust and combed his greasy hair with a threesome of dirty fingernails. Some facts about Reinhold Zucker. He was 24. When he won a round of cards, he gloated. He would hold the thin cylinders of tobacco to his nose and breathe them in. "The smell of victory," he would say. Oh, and one more thing. He would die with his mouth open. Unlike the young man to his left, Hans Hubermann didn't gloat when he won. He was even generous enough to give each colleague one of his cigarettes back and light it for him. All but Reinhold Zucker took up the invitation. He snatched at the offering and flung it back to the middle of the turned-over box.
"I don't need your charity, old man,"
He stood up and left.
"What's wrong with him?"
the sergeant inquired, but no one cared enough to answer. Reinhold Zucker was just a 24-year-old boy who could not play cards to save his life. Had he not lost his cigarettes to Hans Hubermann, he wouldn't have despised him. If he hadn't despised him, he might not have taken his place a few weeks later on a fairly innocuous road. One seat, two men, a short argument, and me. It kills me sometimes how people die. The Snows of Stalingrad. In the middle of January 1943, the corridor of Himmel Street was its dark, miserable self. Liesel shut the gate and made her way to Frau Holzapfel's door and knocked. She was surprised by the answerer. Her first thought was that the man must have been one of her sons, but he did not look like either of the brothers in the framed photos by the door. He seemed far too old, although it was difficult to tell. His face was dotted with whiskers, and his eyes looked painful and loud. A bandaged hand fell out of his coat sleeve, and cherries of blood were seeping through the wrapping.
"Perhaps you should come back later."
Liesel tried to look past him. She was close to calling out to Frau Holzapfel, but the man blocked her.
"Child," he said, "come back later. I'll get you. Where are you from?"
More than 3 hours later, a knock arrived at 33 Himmel Street, and the man stood before her. The cherries of blood had grown into plums.
"She's ready for you now."
Outside, in the fuzzy grey light, Liesel couldn't help asking the man what had happened to his hand. He blew some air from his nostrils, a single syllable, before his reply.
"Stalingrad."
"Sorry?"
He had looked into the wind when he spoke.
"I couldn't hear you."
He answered again, only louder, and now he answered the question fully.
"Stalingrad happened to my hand. I was shot in the ribs, and I had three of my fingers blown off. Does that answer your question?"
He placed his uninjured hand in his pocket and shivered with contempt for the German wind.
"You think it's cold here?"
Liesel touched the wall at her side. She couldn't lie.
"Yes, of course."
The man laughed.
"This isn't cold."
He pulled out a cigarette and placed it in his mouth. One-handed, he tried to light a match. In the dismal weather, it would have been difficult with both hands, but with just the one, it was impossible. He dropped the matchbook and swore. Liesel picked it up. She took his cigarette and put it in her mouth. She, too, could not light it.
"You have to suck on it," the man explained. "In this weather, it only lights when you suck. Verstehst?"
She gave it another go, trying to remember how Papa did it. This time, her mouth filled with smoke. It climbed her teeth and scratched her throat, but she restrained herself from coughing.
"Well done."
When he took the cigarette and breathed it in, he reached out his uninjured hand, his left.
"Michael Holzapfel."
"Liesel Memminger."
"You're coming to read to my mother?"
Rosa arrived behind her at that point, and Liesel could feel the shock at her back.
"Michael," she asked, "is that you?"
Michael Holzapfel nodded.
"Guten Tag, Frau Hubermann. It's been a long time."
"You look so...
old."
Rosa was still in shock, but she composed herself.
"Would you like to come in? I see you met my foster daughter."
Her voice trailed off as she noticed the bloodied hand. "My brother's dead," said Michael Holzapfel, and he could not have delivered the punch any better with his one usable fist. For Rosa staggered. Certainly war meant dying, but it always shifted the ground beneath a person's feet when it was someone who had once lived and breathed in close proximity. Rosa had watched both of the Holzapfel boys grow up. The oldened young man somehow found a way to list what happened without losing his nerve.
"I was in one of the buildings we used for a hospital when they brought him in. It was a week before I was coming home. I spent 3 days of that week sitting with him before he died."
"I'm sorry."
The words didn't seem to come from Rosa's mouth. It was someone else standing behind Liesel Memminger that evening, but she did not dare to look.
"Please," Michael stopped her, "don't say anything else. Can I take the girl to read? I doubt my mother will hear it, but she said for her to come."
"Yes, take her." They were halfway down the path when Michael Holtzapfel remembered himself and returned.
"Rosa!"
There was a moment of waiting while Mama re-widened the door.
"I heard your son was there, in Russia. I ran into someone else from Malking and they told me. But I'm sure you knew that already."
Rosa tried to prevent his exit. She rushed out and held his sleeve.
"No, he left here one day and never came back. We tried to find him, but then so much happened, there was..."
Michael Holtzapfel was determined to escape. The last thing he wanted to hear was yet another sob story. Pulling himself away, he said,
"As far as I know, he's alive."
He joined Liesel at the gate, but the girl did not walk next door. She watched Rosa's face. It lifted and dropped in the same moment.
"Mama!"
Rosa raised her hand.
"Go!"
Liesel waited.
"I said, go!"
When she caught up to him, the returned soldier tried to make conversation. He must have regretted his verbal mistake with Rosa, and he tried to bury it beneath some other words. Holding up the bandaged hand, he said,
"I still can't get it to stop bleeding."
Liesel was actually glad to enter the Holtzapfel's kitchen. The sooner she started reading, the better. Frau Holtzapfel sat with wet streams of wire on her face. Her son was dead. But that was only the half of it. She would never really know how it occurred. But I can tell you without question that one of us here knows. I always seem to know what happened when there was snow and guns and the various confusions of human language. When I imagine Frau Holtzapfel's kitchen from the book thief's words, I don't see the stove or the wooden spoons or the water pump or anything of the sort. Not to begin with, anyway. What I see is the Russian winter and the snow falling from the ceiling and the fate of Frau Holtzapfel's second son. His name was Robert, and what happened to him was this. A small war story. His legs were blown off at the shins, and he died with his brother watching in a cold, stench-filled hospital. It was Russia, January the 5th, 1943, and just another icy day. Out among the city and snow, there were dead Russians and Germans everywhere. Those who remained were firing into the blank pages in front of them. Three languages interwove, the Russian, the bullets, the German. As I made my way through the fallen souls, one of the men was saying, "My stomach is itchy." He said it many times over. Despite his shock, he crawled up ahead to a dark, disfigured figure who sat streaming on the ground. When the soldier with the wounded stomach arrived, he could see that it was Robert Holtzapfel. His hands were caked in blood, and he was heaping snow onto the area just above his shins, where his legs had been chopped off by the last explosion. There were hot hands and a red scream. Steam rose from the ground. The sight and smell of rotting snow.
"It's me," the soldier said to him. "It's Peter."
He dragged himself a few inches closer.
"Peter?"
Robert asked, a vanishing voice. He must have felt me nearby. A second time.
"Peter?"
For some reason, dying men always ask questions they know the answer to. Perhaps it's so they can die being right. The voices suddenly all sounded the same. Robert Holtzapfel collapsed to his right onto the cold and steamy ground. I'm sure he expected to meet me there and then. He didn't. Unfortunately for the young German, I did not take him that afternoon. I stepped over him with the other poor souls in my arms and made my way back to the Russians. Back and forth I travelled. Disassembled men. It was no ski trip, I can tell you. As Michael told his mother, it was 3 very long days later that I finally came for the soldier who left his feet behind in Stalingrad. I showed